Welcome to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio for Wednesday, June 29th, 2022. President Joe Biden at the NATO summit in Spain announcing an increase in U.S. military troops and weaponry to Eastern Europe, including a permanent presence in Poland. He says in a moment when Russian President Vladimir Putin has shattered peace in Europe and attacked the very tenets of rule-based order, the United States and our allies, we're going to step up, we're stepping up, referring to Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Also, NATO formally inviting Sweden and Finland to join the military alliance after member Turkey dropped its objection. We'll talk about the NATO summit with Politico's defense reporter in Madrid. The U.S. Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell saying the U.S. economy is in strong shape and can handle the interest rate increases the Fed has been imposing to try to keep inflation from getting out of control. Powell today taking part in a central bankers forum in Portugal. U.S. voters going to the polls for the first time since the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade, giving states and the voters choosing elected leaders the power to determine whether abortion will be legal or illegal in that state. We'll talk about it with a CQ Roll Call elections analyst about whether Republican or Democratic candidates for office are most likely to benefit. From USA Today, Dateline Madrid, President Joe Biden pledged Wednesday to boost the U.S. military presence in Eastern Europe, including establishing a permanent presence in Poland, as he gathered Wednesday with other NATO leaders at a summit intended to show resolve against Russian President Vladimir Putin's war in Ukraine. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg announced this week the organization would put 300,000 troops on high alert in response to Russia's invasion. More than 40,000 are currently under NATO command. President Biden meeting one-on-one with the NATO Secretary General today, the two also talking about Finland and Sweden joining the military alliance.
Our meetings today, we're going to approve a new NATO strategic concept and reaffirm the unity and determination of our alliance to defend every inch of NATO territory. And Article 5 is sacrosanct, and we mean it when we say an attack against one is an attack against all, every inch. And so, at this summit, the full alliance is going to welcome Finland and Sweden, their historic application for membership, and their decision to move away from neutrality and the tradition of neutrality to join NATO alliance is going to make us stronger and more secure, and NATO stronger. We're sending an unmistakable message, in my view, and I think yours as well, that NATO is strong, united, and the steps we're taking during this summit are going to further augment our collective strength. To that end, today I'm announcing the United States will enhance our force posture in Europe and respond to the changed security environment, as well as strengthening our collective security. Earlier this year, we surged 20,000 additional U.S. forces to Europe to bolster our alliance in response to Russia's aggressive move, bringing our force total in Europe to 100,000. We're going to continue to adjust our posture based on the threat in close consultation with our allies. Here in Spain, we're going to work with our ally to increase U.S. Navy destroyers stationed in Spain's Rota naval base from four to six. Four to six destroyers. In Poland, we're going to establish a permanent headquarters of the U.S. 5th Army Corps, and strengthening our U.S.-NATO interoperability across the entire eastern flank. We're going to maintain additional rotational brigade, which is 3,000 fighters and another 2,000 personnel, combat team here in Europe, headquartered in Romania. And we're going to enhance our rotational deployments in the Baltic states. And we're going to send two additional F-35 squadrons to the UK and station additional air defense and other capabilities in Germany and in Italy. And together, our allies, we're going to make up sure that NATO is ready to meet threats from all directions across every domain, land, air, and the sea. In a moment when Putin has shattered peace in Europe and attacked the very, very tenets of rule-based order, the United States and our allies, we're going to step up. We're stepping up. We're proving that NATO is more needed now than it ever has been, and it's as important as it ever has been. So I want to thank you, Jens, for leading the alliance through this crisis, and for your work to strengthen NATO for all the challenges lie ahead. And I genuinely look forward to our discussion today. And again, thank you for your leadership. It's important.
Thank you so much, President Biden. Dear Joe, it's really great to see you here in Madrid so soon after we met in the White House in Washington. And thank you for your personal leadership and the U.S. commitment to NATO, to European security, demonstrated by the announcements you just made to further increase U.S. presence in Europe. And this really demonstrates your decisive leadership in strengthening the transatlantic bond. And we also see that in the unwavering support from you and from the United States to Ukraine. That will be a main issue at the summit today. We'll meet with President Zelensky. He will address the summit. And as you said, this will be an historic summit. It will be a transformative summit where we'll make decisions that will actually change this alliance for many years to come. We will agree a new strategic concept, the blueprint for NATO into the future, a more dangerous world, a more competitive world. We will agree the biggest overhaul of our collective defense deterrence since the end of the Cold War, and U.S. is, of course, very much part of that. And then we will invite Finland and Sweden to join NATO. And that demonstrates that NATO's door is open. It demonstrates that President Putin has not succeeded in closing NATO's door. He is getting the opposite of what he wants. He wants less NATO. President Putin is getting more NATO by Finland and Sweden joining our alliance. We will agree a comprehensive assistance package for Ukraine. And then I also welcome the fact that we are able now to state that actually European allies and Canada are stepping up with more troops, higher readiness, and also increased defense spending. New figures shows that they have added $350 billion extra US dollars for defense since we made the pledge back in 2014. So all in all, this demonstrates unity and the strength of our alliance. So thank you.
You know, I was asked about this one, about Finland and Sweden, when each of their leaders came to the White House. And I said, Putin was looking for the Finlandization of Europe. You're going to get the NATOization of Europe. And that's exactly what he didn't want, but exactly what needs to be done to guarantee security for Europe. And I think it's necessary, and I'm looking forward to it happening formally.
Thank you so much again.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys.
Okay, we're moving on.
President Joe Biden and the NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg at the start of their one-on-one meeting at the NATO Leaders Summit in Madrid, Spain. Reuters has a story. The Biden administration threw its support on Wednesday behind the potential sale of U.S. F-16 fighter jets to Turkey a day after Ankara lifted a veto of NATO membership for Finland and Sweden. Celeste Wallander, Assistant Secretary for Defense for International Security Affairs at the Pentagon, told reporters on a call that strong Turkish defense capabilities would reinforce NATO's defenses. The article goes on, Turkey made a request in October to the United States to buy 40 Lockheed Martin-made F-16 fighters and nearly 80 modernization kits for its existing warplanes. Washington had not previously openly expressed any opinion on the sale, aside from saying all weapon sales would have to go through the necessary legal process. That from Reuters. President Biden also had a meeting today with the president of Turkey, Recep Tayyip Erdogan.
Thank you for making the effort to come over. I want to particularly thank you for what you did putting together the situation with regard to Finland and Sweden, and all the incredible work you're doing to try to get grain out of Ukraine and Russia. I mean, you're doing a great job. I just want to thank you. And I'd like to talk to you about those things if we have a chance. So, the floor is yours.
Ben de özellikle uzun bir aradan sonra tekrar sizlerle bir...
Really mentioned that it gives me great... Mr. President, it gives me great pleasure to be able to get together with you after a long interval. And this NATO summit that we're attending, in terms of its agenda, is going to be quite busy and it's going to be quite important. And tomorrow, The activities will be sustained, and thanks to our efforts, we believe that we will be able to go back to our countries with our hands full and with full satisfaction. And as the United States, we think your pioneering in this regard is going to be crucial in terms of strengthening NATO for the future, and it's going to have a very positive contribution to the process between Ukraine and Russia. The Russia and Ukraine conflict and the negative developments with regards to taking out of the grain from the Ukrainian ports, as well as the developments involving oil and natural gas, require all of us to work together in order to settle the disputes once and for all. I hope and pray that we will be able to establish a balanced diplomacy in order to cultivate positive results, especially with regards to the grain. There are countries deprived of the grains, and we will open corridors and we will allow them to have access to the grains that they so need. Thank you.
Your leadership. Thank you. I really mean it. Thank you.
Thank you, guys. Thank you. Come on, guys. Let's go. Please turn around. Thank you.
President Biden and the Turkish President Erdogan meeting it at the NATO summit in Spain. Paul McCleary is a defense reporter with Politico and has been following the developments at the NATO summit. He joins us now by phone. Turkey agreeing to allow Finland and Sweden to join NATO, and now we hear the sale of U.S. F-16 fighter jets to Turkey being reviewed by the administration. Are these two linked?
White House officials have said that they're not necessarily linked, but it is quite a coincidence that hours after Turkey agrees to sign off on a document allowing Sweden and Finland to eventually enter NATO, that DOD and White House officials have brought up this deal. This is something that the White House has for a while been open to. The State Department sent a letter to Capitol Hill earlier this year saying that they're open to selling these F-16 modernization kits. Turkey already has many of these jets, and there's kits that would modernize the plane, and they also want some of these the F-16V, some very new F-16s. So it's a way for Biden administration to bring Turkey maybe back into the fold a little bit after removing them from the F-35 program President Trump did in 2019, and after Turkey started buying Russian weapons. So while they might not be explicitly linked, one would think that there's definitely some causality there.
With Finland and Sweden now well on the path towards joining NATO, how does that change or bolster the alliance?
It's one of the most significant events in decades for the alliance. I mean, Finland and Sweden have always been generally non-aligned, but they've been buying American and Western military equipment for years. Sweden in particular has a robust defense industry that sells fighter planes and missile defense systems and anti-air systems across Europe and even to the United States. And it will add to the Baltic area, the Baltic area in NATO. So you have Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia up in the Baltic, very small countries, very small defense budgets. They are very worried about Russia. They have been for a long time. They're on one side of the Baltic, Finland and Sweden are on the other. So this would almost make the Baltic Sea a NATO lake. It is, with two modern militaries, with robust economies, already have high levels of defense spending, it is a massive add for the alliance.
Earlier, we heard the announcement from President Biden about sending more U.S. troops and equipment. What is the message being sent to Russian President Putin?
I mean, it's clear that the United States isn't going away, isn't backing down, and nor is the NATO alliance. Most of what the United States is doing, setting up a core army headquarters in Poland that will allow the quick movement of troops and logistics kind of throughout Eastern Europe. There's going to be another rotational brigade that goes to Romania. It's something that the Romanians have been asking for years. And that brigade, based in Romania, will be able to move around Eastern Europe. Two more ships to Rota, Spain, these Arleigh Burke-class destroyers there. They can shoot Tomahawk missiles. They can do air defense. There's already four American ships there in Rota, so this would make six. And my understanding is that this won't happen. This will probably be the last of everything that's going to happen because it takes a lot to take a destroyer with 300 sailors on it and home port it somewhere else. You know, the logistics of it and just upending, you know, the sailors' lives and deploying them to another country. So, but that will be a huge, huge boost in the Mediterranean. And it could even reach into Eastern Europe with their missile defense and land attack capabilities.
We're talking with Paul McCleary, defense reporter with Politico. With Russia's invasion of Ukraine, the NATO meetings have a sense of everyone on the same page. But what challenges, what disagreements have there been any as the leaders are meeting?
None made very explicitly or publicly, but the war in Ukraine does really hang over the whole proceedings, which, you know, with Sweden and Finland joining, otherwise this is a celebration. But with the war grinding on in Ukraine and really no end in sight, right? The Ukrainian government is really pushing NATO countries to send more weapons and send it very quickly. Whereas the folks from NATO I've been speaking to here in Madrid over the past 2 days, they seem to be taking more of a long-term approach, saying we need to train the Ukrainians, we need to prepare them, you know, for fighting into 2023 and maybe beyond. So there may be a little bit of a disconnect between what the Ukrainians are looking for and think they can do and what NATO is both capable and willing to do. But that's not really that's not really splintering the alliance in any way. The alliance kind of seems mostly united into taking a little bit slower of an approach than the Ukrainians might want, which will create tension down the line.
And finally, a lot of focus on Europe, but China has been mentioned quite a bit at the NATO summit.
It has, yeah. NATO released its strategic concept document, the first in over a decade, which doesn't necessarily realign the alliance, but it provides a new strategic outline for what countries should expect, what countries should think about buying, what countries should think about developing and politically. And this one mentions China for the first time. They keep Russia right up top as a major threat to Europe and to the alliance. And China is more of an economic issue and a technology sharing issue, obviously with semiconductors and microchips and things like that. So NATO is dipping its toes here into the Indo-Pacific. And for the first time this year, countries like New Zealand, Australia, Japan, and South Korea were invited to the conference. And their heads of state are here in Madrid meeting with NATO leaders and NATO defense ministers, which is, if nothing else, hugely symbolic of the how NATO and Europe sees themselves connected to the Asia-Pacific region and how they want to work together with them to blunt China's influence.
Paul McCleary, defense reporter with Politico, following the NATO summit in Spain. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And President Biden having a meeting today on the sidelines of the NATO summit in Madrid with the South Korean president and Japanese prime minister. Voice of America reporting on it, saying the three expressed new worries about the North Korean nuclear threat. In brief comments ahead of their trilateral meeting, President Biden said, "We remain deeply concerned that North Korea has continued escalatory ballistic missiles and tests and has the potential to conduct a nuclear test." Biden said the U.S., South Korea, and Japan have a shared objective, including complete denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula and a free and open Indo-Pacific. Some reporting from Voice of America. Members of President Biden's National Security Cabinet also joining him on the trip, including Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin and Secretary of State Antony Blinken. Blinken taking part in a conversation about NATO with the Spanish Foreign Minister, Jose Manuel Alvarez. It was moderated by NPR reporter Michelle Martin. Topics included Russia's war in Ukraine, but also other issues facing NATO countries, including immigration. Here's a bit of it where Michelle Martin asks about recent tragic incidents involving migrants on both sides of the Atlantic Ocean.
There were two significant recent disasters affecting both of your countries, both related to irregular immigration, just in the last couple of weeks. In Melilla, at least 37 people died attempting to cross. In the United States, at least 50 people died who were being smuggled into the country, given that both of your countries, our countries, are they're national borders, but they're also NATO borders. I mean, is it time for NATO to turn its attention to mass migration in some meaningful way and to put some urgency behind that?
Yeah, well, the two specific events that you pointed out is a human tragedy, and it's appalling to all of us. And what that points out is the complexity of the phenomenon of irregular migration and how both the origin and transit countries and the countries that we are receiving illegal migrants, we must cooperate as strongly as possible to try to channel and to deal with this challenge in the best way. And at the same time, we are talking about borders in which inequality is probably at its most. The Melilla border is a border between European Union and Africa, probably the most unequal and unbalanced border wherever reference you take, GDP, youth, whatever. And it's very complicated to try to channel those irregular flows. So we have to go also to the root causes, which is underdevelopment. That's why we have also to cooperate with all those countries. And of course, the risk is always, as we saw in the Belarus border with Poland, that someone can use that as a weapon against our territorial integrity or our sovereignty. That's why in the strategic concept of Madrid, irregular migration, if it's used as a political tool, it can be a threat.
But, agreed, but is NATO a vehicle to address this with urgency, to apply the same kind of urgency and focused attention to, I think we would all agree, it is a humanitarian disaster, it's a moral disaster, and it also has claimed many, many lives, probably more than we even know. So, Mr. Secretary, is NATO an appropriate vehicle to address this?
First thing we have to recognize is we are living a historic moment when it comes to irregular migration and migration of all sorts. There are more people on the move around the world, 100 million forcibly displaced in one way or another from their homes, more than at any time since we've actually recorded these facts and this information. Mm-hmm. And it is happening across the world, in our own hemisphere, on our own border. One of the interesting things, Michelle, is that the United States and Spain, I'll leave aside NATO for the minute, are working closely together, including in the Western Hemisphere, to try to deal with the irregular migration that we're seeing there. We just came back together before coming to NATO. We were at the Summit of the Americas in Los Angeles. For the first time, the countries in our hemisphere, through what's called the Los Angeles Declaration, said we have shared responsibilities when it comes to trying to deal with migration, because not a single one of us alone can deal with it effectively. And we are following through on a number of things that we've agreed to try to work on this collectively. Spain is a partner in this effort with other countries in the hemisphere, with the United States. So, for sure, we need collective approaches to this.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken, sitting beside the Spanish Foreign Minister, Jose Manuel Alvarez, panel moderated by National Public Radio reporter Michelle Martin, on the sidelines of the NATO summit in Madrid. President Biden has one more day at the NATO summit with a scheduled press conference on Thursday before flying back to Washington, D.C. The U.S. Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell, also in Europe at a European Central Bank forum in Sintra, Portugal. Bloomberg News reports that Powell said the U.S. economy is in strong shape and the central bank can reduce inflation to 2% while maintaining a solid labor market, even though that task has become more challenging in recent months. The article goes on. He also vowed to ensure rapid price increases don't become entrenched, saying that we will not allow a transition from low inflation environment to a high inflation environment. Here's Chair Powell.
So the U.S. economy is actually in pretty strong shape. So if you look back a year, the U.S. economy grew more than 5.5%. It was really the big reopening year. Mm-hmm. And so we had expected this year to be that growth would moderate to a more sustainable path. We also, of course, are raising interest rates, and the aim of that is to slow growth down so that supply will have a chance to catch up. We hope that growth can still remain positive. But if you look at it, the strength of the economy, households are in very strong financial shape. They've still got a lot of excess savings from from, you know, forced saving from not being able to travel and things like that, and also from fiscal transfers. So households are overall, not every household, and not the ones at the lower end of the income spectrum, but overall in strong shape. The same thing is true of businesses, very, very low rates of default and things like that, lots of cash on the balance sheet. The labor market is tremendously strong, you know, still averaging very, very high job growth per month. So overall, the U.S. economy is well positioned to withstand tighter monetary policy, we think.
But is it automatically a trade-off between fighting inflation or taking care of the economy? And how far are you willing to go with interest rate hikes?
So I guess I'd say it this way. Our aim is to have growth moderate. It's sort of a necessary adjustment that needs to happen so that, again, supply can catch up. It could be supply of workers. It could be time for the supply chains to improve. So the sense of that is that if we can get, right now, supply and demand are really out of balance in many parts of the U.S. economy, labor market being a big example of that. We need to get them better in balance so that inflation can come down. And that's the aim of what we're doing. Now, we don't have precision tools, obviously. Monetary policy, famously a blunt tool. That is our aim. That is our intention. We think that there are pathways for us to achieve that, to achieve the path back to 2% inflation, while still sustaining a strong labor market. We believe we can do that. That is our aim. Mm-hmm. There's no guarantee that we can do that. It's obviously something that's going to be quite challenging, and I would also say that the events of the last few months have made it significantly more challenging, thinking there particularly of the war in Ukraine, which has, you know, added tremendously to inflationary pressures around food and energy commodities and agricultural chemicals and industrial chemicals and things like that. So it's gotten harder. The pathways have gotten narrower. Nonetheless, that is our aim, and we believe that there are pathways to achieve that.
Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell at a forum hosted by Bloomberg and the European Central Bank. This was in Portugal. Panel also included the bank president, Christine Lagarde. She says the era of low inflation worldwide is behind us.
I don't think that we're going to go back to that environment of low inflation. And I think that there are forces that have been unleashed as a result of the pandemic, as a result of this massive geopolitical shock that we are facing now, that are going to change the picture and the landscape within which we operate. If I look at our euro area, for instance, we have record low unemployment. We have inflation expectations, however imprecise and with the pinch of salt that was discussed at the last panel, which was excellent, we have inflation expectations that are much, much higher than they were. That's for the internal matters. But if you look at the rest of the world, a lot of the movements that we've experienced in the last 20 years was predicated on globalization, on the breaking down of supply chains, on the reduction of cost, on the just on time. That has changed and will probably change continuously towards a system that we are not certain about at this point in time, which is much debated. Some would argue that globalization will continue in a different format. Some would argue that the place where you manufacture, the place from which you provide services, is going to be determined by different factors than just cost. It will be about cost as usual, but it's also going to be about where do I locate my services, where do I employ people, where do I reduce my costs, and are those areas, geographical as well as political, actually foes or friends? And do I have some predictability about the future of my production or the providing of my services? And the third factor that is going to change the scene from my vantage point is the way in which we produce. And I think that the shift that we're observing in Europe, certainly, towards green transition is also going to change dramatically the way in which we operate. And all those forces are going to produce inflation, deflationary impact that, you know, are still to be measured. But in the short run, I have some ideas as to where it's heading.
Christine Lagarde is president of the European Central Bank, a former managing director of the International Monetary Fund, on a panel in central Portugal with other central bankers, including U.S. Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell and Andrew Bailey, governor of the Bank of England. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average up 82 points, NASDAQ down 3, S&P 500 down 2. Washington Today continues in a moment. Welcome back to Washington Today, which is available as a podcast on the free C-SPAN Now mobile video app and wherever you get your podcasts. Some early election contests in the United States testing the impact of the Supreme Court's decision to overturn Roe v. Wade and no longer make abortion a constitutional right, leaving the choice of illegal or legal up to the states. This from Associated Press. The abortion debate consumed the nation this week, but there was no race where it mattered more than Colorado's Republican primary for the U.S. Senate, where businessman Joe O'Day became one of the only abortion rights supporting Republicans in the nation to win a statewide primary this year. He said he backs a ban on late-term abortions and government funding of abortions, but the decision to terminate a pregnancy in the initial months is between a person and their God. O'Day beat back a stiff challenge from State Representative Ron Hanks, a Trump loyalist who opposed abortion with no exceptions for rape, incest, or the life of the mother. That from Associated Press. Here's a minute of Joe O'Day giving a victory speech Tuesday night.
Colorado wants its leaders to be independent. Michael Bennett is not independent. I am. That's why tonight, when they counted the votes, independents showed up. They voted for me in this primary, and we're going to work hard to keep them in our coalition this fall. Our coalition is what made this victory possible. It's Trump Republicans, GOP Republicans, log cabin Republicans, pro-life, pro-choice Republicans, independents, parents, the police, seniors, veterans, unions, farmers, rural, urban, and suburban voters, and yes, even disenfranchised Democrats that have come onto our team. Our campaign is a big tent, and there's room for plenty more. It's a coalition of people who don't agree on every issue, every time. But we are united in a deep and abiding love of our country and a profound belief that America is so much better than what we have become. These are the voices I will fight for in the U.S. Senate.
Senate Republican nominee Joe O'Day in Colorado Tuesday night after his primary victory. He mentioned Senator Michael Bennett. That's the incumbent Democratic senator that he'll be facing in the general election in November. Associated Press article adding that if Joe O'Day wins, he would become just the third Senate Republican and the only male to support abortion rights. The chair of the Republican National Committee, Ronna McDaniel, asked today on Fox News Channel about voters' views on abortion following the Supreme Court's decision to overturn Roe v. Wade.
The other big story is what happened with Roe v. Wade. Have you seen any early polling that shows how that might challenge you more than before Roe v. Wade was overturned?
We'll be looking at recent polling, but I'll say this, Brian, it was leaked in April, remember? So this is a little baked in, and we have seen no movement in the polling once this was leaked. So I think a lot of voters had seen this. They expected Roe v. Wade to be overturned, and it did not change the numbers at all.
All right, so let's take a look at something else that was pretty fascinating that emerged. I believe it was AP that revealed that more than 1 million voters went out of their way, because most people don't, even if they're going to vote a different way, to switch parties from Democrat to Republican. And most of those in the suburbs where President Trump was shedding voters last time around. What does your micro polling show you the reason is why?
Well, we're seeing it everywhere. We've been outpacing Dems 4-1 in Pennsylvania, in North Carolina 3-1, Florida. We just overtook the Democrats for the first time in history with more Republicans registered. Obviously, the RNC's invested a lot in this, so we've been monitoring this. It's common sense issues. Parents should have a say in their kids' education. We should be energy independent. We should have a secure border. Crime is a big issue. All of these things are moving voters to the Republican Party as they're watching the Democrats become more and more extreme.
And by the way, we should say 630,000 switched to Democrat from Republican, but was far outstripped by the million plus that you guys have gotten.
RNC Chair Ronna McDaniel on the Fox News Channel. An article by CQ Roll Call elections analyst Nathan Gonzalez begins, "The Supreme Court Dobbs decision overturning Roe v. Wade is a historic event, but will take at least a few weeks, if not longer, to know whether it is an election-changing event." But he also writes, "Of course, there's an appetite for immediate reaction, so there are already at least two new surveys helping shape the early narrative." Nathan Gonzalez joining us now by phone. Thank you very much. What did the surveys show?
Well, the surveys have multiple questions. And one of my problems, though, initially, is that I think it's too soon to gauge what the public thinks about this. I mean, some of the first surveys that came out were within hours of the decision coming down. I'm not convinced that voters really had time to wrestle with what happened, or that it's okay to let the decision marinate a little bit. But one of the key findings was that a majority of Americans believe that disapprove of the reversal of Roe v. Wade. And actually, this shouldn't be a surprise. This is in line with what voters have thought for going back a couple of decades. But there's nuance in abortion polling, in that if you ask voters if they think abortion should be legal in the first trimester, a majority of Americans will say yes. If you ask Americans if they think abortion should be legal in the second and third trimester, a majority of Americans will say no. But that nuance is lost right now in the partisan political fight.
If you ask somebody, what do you think about abortion? That's one question. But then you need to ask, well, where does abortion fit in your rank of priorities of issues? Do we know the answer to that?
Not yet. I think that when we do get those sorts of that sort of survey data, I think what we're going to find is that the economy still reigns supreme, or is still a top priority for voters. And it is, and under the economic umbrella, there's lots of different issues: inflation, gas prices, supply chain issues. Because I think that those economic issues are issues that more voters are wrestling with on a more regular basis. Now, that's not to undermine the seriousness of the Supreme Court decision. I think what we're going to see is that even if there isn't a shift on a national level, with the trajectory of these elections being probably good for Republicans, we could see it have an individual race impact, where in individual races where candidates, particularly Republicans, are having to wrestle with how closely to align themselves with states that have now imposed more restrictive measures on access to abortion. How do they wrestle with those laws when they are running in districts and states that are more moderate or more politically balanced?
We just had a series of campaign primaries last night, first since the Supreme Court ruling. Did you see any impact of the abortion issue and the ruling in any of the races you've been following?
It's hard to pull out it's hard to pull out, I think, one specific factor in any campaign or any race, because they are kind of complex organisms with lots of different moving parts and moving pieces, moving cells. There has been some attention on a kind of an obscure special election in Nebraska, where the Democratic candidate overperformed. Republicans still held on to the seat. This is the seat that was left vacant by Congressman Jeff Fortenberry. But I'm just reluctant to draw too many conclusions, in part because, again, the decision just happened, and I'm not sure it's we just don't have the data to support that particular narrative.
We're talking with Nathan Gonzalez from CQ Roll Call. Another line from your article at rollcall.com: in order for abortion to make an impact on the midterm elections, it probably needs to boost President Joe Biden's political standing. I'm skeptical the Dobbs decision will do it. Why is that?
Well, when you look at President Biden's job rating, it has been fairly static for months. Static meaning hasn't dramatically improved or gotten worse, and that has been in the face of some other significant events, whether it's adding a black woman to the Supreme Court, the invasion of Ukraine. This abortion issue is more domestic and is not happening overseas. But I feel like most Americans have already made up their mind about whether they're going to support or oppose the president, support or oppose Democratic candidates. And it is hard to move people off of their previous partisan intent. So I think that what is more likely to potentially help Biden would be something such as some economic good news on the economy front, whatever that might be. And this and the Dobbs decision is lingering out there as a potential boost for Democrats, but we don't have, but it's not immediately apparent that that's going to happen.
Well, as we wait to see whether it has any impact, what is the latest predictions for the midterm elections, the control of Congress from your organization?
I think Republicans are most likely to win back both the House and the Senate. The House is easier, there's an easier path because Republicans only need to gain 4 seats out of 435 in order to get back to the House majority. The Republicans only need a net gain of one seat in the Senate, but the most competitive races, the races are close, and in some places that Republicans should end up winning, they have some work to do. Their candidate needs to repair some, maybe some ill will from primaries or consolidate Republican votes, and there's still hard work to do. But I think the most likely outcome is still Republicans winning back Congress in November.
Nathan Gonzalez, elections analyst with CQ Roll Call. Again, find his story at rollcall.com. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
U.S. Supreme Court issuing a few more rulings today, both 5-4. One lets a U.S. Army reservist who was injured during the Iraq War pursue a lawsuit against Texas for alleged job discrimination. The court rejected Texas' claim of sovereign immunity, in other words, saying they cannot be sued. Another case allows Oklahoma to prosecute non-Native Americans for crimes convicted on tribal land when the victim is Native American. Thursday will be the final decision day for the Supreme Court, and Justice Stephen Breyer announcing today that he'll be formally resigning Thursday at noon Eastern, and the Supreme Court saying there's going to be a ceremony to swear in his replacement as the new justice, Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson, recently confirmed by the U.S. Senate. From ITV in Great Britain, sources close to Dominic Raab have attempted to explain his controversial wink at Prime Minister's questions, which appeared to be directed at Angela Rayner, after the Deputy Prime Minister was accused of sexism by Twitter users. The two deputies were going head-to-head at PMQs in Boris Johnson's absence, with the Prime Minister out of the country for a NATO summit. That from ITV. Prime Minister's questions, covered by C-SPAN. Here's the moment, the audio anyway. The wink happens when Rob says for the second time, she talks about working people.
She talks about working people. She talks about working people. She talks about working people. Where was the Right Honourable Lady when the comrades were on the picket line last Thursday? Where was she when the Labour front bench were joining them rather than standing up for the public? She was at the Glyndebourne Music Festival, sipping champagne, listening to opera. Champagne socialism is back in the Labour Party.
Mr. Speaker, that says a lot about the party opposite. I'll tell them a few things about militancy. It's this government that are acting in a militant way. And while they should have been at the negotiating table, they were at the banqueting table getting hundreds of thousands squeezed out of their donors instead of dealing with a crisis.
That's the British Deputy Labour leader Angela Rayner with the Deputy Prime Minister Dominic Raab of the Conservative Party during Prime Minister's questions in the House of Commons in London, and they were discussing a train workers' strike. Again, Raab winking at the beginning of that clip, and you can see the video of it at cspan.org. More from the ITV news story. Social media was awash with accusations of misogyny after Twitter users posted footage of the wink, but Rob's team says Raab was actually winking at Shadow Scottish Secretary Ian Murray. A source claimed that off camera, Mr. Murray made a comment inaudible to those watching at home in which he muttered it would be no bad thing if Angela Rayner stood for leader of the Labour Party. But Labour Member of Parliament Toby Perkins tweeting, "I will never unsee Dominic Raab's wink from the dispatch box to Angela Rayner. I feel soiled." And then Angela Rayner retweeting, "Imagine how I feel." Thanks for listening to Washington Today. You can get more of Washington's top stories sent to you every day by subscribing to C-SPAN's evening newsletter, word for word. Sign up at c-span.org/connect. Have a good night.